The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform. You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 6th of May 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
Many countries with vaccine manufacturing capacity can start producing their own vaccines by waiving intellectual property rights as provided for in the TRIPS agreement. Those provisions are there for use in emergencies. If now is not a time to use them, then when?
Momentum gathers behind an idea to temporarily lift patent protection for coronavirus vaccines. Could it help bring an end to the pandemic? We'll also head to Hong Kong to find out about the city's continued crackdown on political dissent. Plus, an update from the Colombian capital, Bogotá. And then Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here with this week's Global Countdown. What have you got for us, Faye?
Tone, today we're heading to Africa's seventh most populous country. And all I can say, they're a bunch of romantics.
Oh, I can't wait for more. On that, thank you, Fernando. All that and more ahead here on The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. The United States has thrown its support behind a World Trade Organization plan to temporarily lift patent protection for coronavirus vaccines. It's hoped that the move, which was proposed by India and South Africa, will significantly boost COVID-19 vaccine production around the world. Well, let's get the latest now with Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. Thanks for joining us as always, Chris, and good afternoon to you. Just give us a sense of how significant this latest move is.
Well, it's a help, isn't it? In the sense that what a lot of countries, India, South Africa, are arguing is that expensive patents owned by the owners of the intellectual property behind these vaccines prevent on-the-ground local manufacture of vaccines, and that could impede vaccine supply. The flip side of this, on the other hand, from the pharmaceutical sector, but also independent, impartial commentators, is that really the bottleneck isn't patents, it's just vaccine supply. It's the ability to make vaccines, because it's not just a recipe book, it is the know-how and the magic hands approach that goes with making these things that's really important too. So it's not everything. It's a step in the right direction in terms of mass production of vaccines, but it's not the whole story.
Now, Chris, it's interesting. Whenever we speak, there are so few precedents to so many different aspects of this pandemic, both the urgency, the scale of the crisis, and indeed the pace, you know, the timetable, if you like, of the reaction. Nevertheless, I did want to ask you about precedents in this space. Is this something that we have seen, that we do see, you know, a willingness to be much more flexible about some, one presumes, pretty entrenched legal positions in order to do things for the broader public good?
Well, I don't think there is a precedent for doing exactly what they're proposing to do here, because we haven't been in this position before. But certainly there are things written into the legal frameworks of various countries that enable them under exceptional circumstances to take exceptional measures. Initially, the EU, initially the US were quite resistant to the idea of doing what the US is now backing. Joe Biden has said that actually he throws his weight behind this initiative. Now the EU are coming to the table. So I think that that while there isn't precedent, there is nevertheless precedent for having had crises in the past that need people to depart from the rule book. But as I say, this is not the whole story, because if you ask people who work for the pharmaceutical sector, they will say that making drugs and medicines is more than just pieces of paper and a recipe book. It is actually the fact that there is an enormous amount of know-how and skill that goes into quality control, quality assurance. And at the end of the day, if you mess up the making of a vaccine or a medicine and it's got someone's brand name on it, or it's attached to a certain company, then it has the potential to do reputational damage, and that could have a knock-on effect, undermining confidence in a vaccine, for example, with the consequence that people would then less likely use it, and that could actually have negative repercussions too. So it's not a simple black and white thing.
Well, Chris, let me ask you then about what could make a more meaningful difference. Is it about a more, I don't know, sort of aggressive program of collaboration, of sharing the expertise that you've talked about? Is it about getting experts from the labs of these private pharma companies or state apparatus out into the communities that need them most to aid these deficits in the knowledge base then on the ground? What in your view does outreach look like that would actually make a more meaningful and more immediate difference?
Well, most of the people I've spoken with, and my own view is, and shared with them, that the bottleneck is the capacity to make vaccines and to make it at scale and to make them fast enough. And part of the reason why we're in the position we're in is because historically many countries did have on-the-ground vaccine manufacturing facilities. But as we move towards a very globalised world where people went from a, you know, just-in-case sort of situation where they had stuff on the ground that they could plug into if they needed to, we went to a just-in-time type mentality where everything arrived from somewhere else and we bought it having ordered it in advance. So most of the UK's vaccine capacity was offshore until now, and most of the world was being supplied by India, by the Serum Institute. So you've got a sort of fairly well understood supply and a fairly well understood capacity and a global export chain to move it around the world. We've now ended up in a situation where actually that's not just going to cut it because the demand is so high, but also getting boots on the ground is also an issue. So really what we need to do is undo about 30 years of atrophy across the world. Not easy to do, easy to say, and get more on-the-ground manufacturing facility close to where these things are needed, because otherwise you're going to face perennial problems of not just making the stuff, but then shipping the stuff, distributing the stuff, storing the stuff. We need infrastructure on the ground across countries in the world, and not just in a few countries, every country really.
And Chris, maybe just finally, what about this vexing question of selling vaccines to the public, by which I don't mean a financial transaction, but more of the sort of marketing idea, selling the idea of engaging with it? Is there any advantage in localized manufacture or this sort of grand gesture in aiding public perception, you know, particularly where there may be high levels of vaccine skepticism or worse, anti-vax movements, in this sort of grand gesture? Does it have a more, I don't know, PR-able application potentially?
I must admit, I'd not considered that facet, but it's a good point. And yes, I think that people do tend to trust things that are made locally, and that may well help to make inroads in that direction. That said, though, plenty of vaccines are being made here in the UK, where I'm talking to you from, and we know that there are certain sectors of society that, regardless of where the vaccines are made, they don't want to have them. They're in the minority, thank goodness, but yes, I think every little helps in this circumstance, and it may well be that the battle can be aided and abetted by actually local manufacturer and local engagement, which is almost certainly going to translate into more support.
Chris, great to hear from you as always, and we're actually going to be speaking to you amongst a selection of other guests in the next week here on Monocle 24 about vaccine scepticism more broadly, so watch this space for that. That was Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. Now here's Carlotta Ribello with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Tom. China's foreign ministry has condemned a joint statement by G7 nations, which expressed support for the self-ruled island of Taiwan. Beijing said the move was a gross interference in China's internal affairs and that the G7 group should work to boost global growth rather than disrupt it. Millions of people across Britain are casting their ballots in the biggest set of votes since the 2019 general election. The outcome will determine the makeup of the Welsh and Scottish parliaments, a number of English councils, and also elect 13 mayors. Today's Monocle Minute reports that Japan's government is attempting to make the country less Tokyo-centric by encouraging employees to leave the capital for the countryside while keeping their jobs in the city. You can find out more by heading over to monocle.com/minute. And finally, it's been revealed that tickets for Broadway will go on sale this week. New York's theaters were forced to close in March 2020 as the pandemic hit the city. But Governor Andrew Cuomo says they will be allowed to reopen at maximum capacity from September. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Tom.
Thanks very much, Carlotta. We head to Hong Kong now, where pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong has been sentenced to an additional 10 months in jail for participating in an unauthorised vigil. Let's get more on this now with our Asia editor and Hong Kong bureau chief, James Chambers. Good evening to you, James. Thanks for joining us on the programme. I guess the first question is, no real surprise at this latest news.
That's right, Tom. No real surprise at all. Poor old Joshua Wong, who's probably Hong Kong's most famous political activist, is already languishing in jail under another sentence related to his activism. And now he's had another 10 months added to that. So while he was due to get out later this year, he'll be in jail well into next year. And this all relates to the annual candlelight vigil that's held in Victoria Park in Hong Kong every June the 4th to commemorate the mainland Chinese crackdown on students in Beijing in 1989. Last year was the first time in 30 years that it hasn't been allowed to go ahead. The police banned it because of the COVID-19 restrictions, but thousands of activists still turned out. And obviously Joshua Wong was one of those leading it. He's obviously a very famous face. There was plenty of evidence of him being there and breaking the law. And he pled guilty to this. So it was pretty much an open and shut case for the judge.
And that being said, James, one does wonder about the brazenness, if you like, with which these cases continue to be prosecuted and indeed these penalties are dispatched. I know that by the letter of the law, of course, it is, as you say, open and shut, but it seems there's ever more confidence about prosecuting these cases, or if not confidence, just a sheer lack of any sort of reflection from Beijing about what it might look like overseas to continue to administer these punishments, including to those already serving time. What are the limits? How much more brazen do these punishments, how much more brazen can they get than this?
Well, I'd say very much more so, because I think this one, where it was relating to the law before the national security law came into place in July last year, this vigil that he attended, this unlawful assembly, took place in June, just before the new national security law came into place. So I guess what we're all waiting to see is how that new law applies. And of course, Joshua Wong is waiting to see how his charges under that law are applied in court. So I guess you could say this latest sentence is under the kind of regular law. And Joshua Wong is very familiar with going in and out of jail in relation to these kinds of protests. But what we don't know and what's yet to see is how the national security law will be applied. Joshua Wong got 10 months for this unlawful assembly. He is facing charges under the security law. We'll have to wait and see how strictly that is applied. On the same day as Joshua Wong was sentenced to 10 months in prison, a handful of schoolboys, of students, were arrested in a dawn raid by the police under the national security law for posts they'd made on social media. Now, I guess that's a lot more alarming, because these are essentially just school kids writing things on social media, and they're now banged up in a police cell facing charges under the security law.
It's pretty scary stuff, James. And I guess I know in a sense this is an unanswerable question, but I'll ask you it in any case. Do we have any sense of, I don't know whether it's more accurate to say whom or what is in the crosshairs of Beijing then, once these new laws are really felt, once the full impact is felt? Is it about targeting specific individuals, groups who are perceived by Beijing to be organisers of dissent? Or is it part of a broader strategy, as you say, to build any dissent completely out of the picture, full stop?
I mean, the big question is how much dissent the Hong Kong government is going to allow after the security law. At the moment, the COVID-19 restrictions give the government and the police an excuse to ban any of these assemblies from taking place. We're meant to have freedom of assembly in Hong Kong. And the big, you know, the big test will be this June the 4th vigil. You know, we're in May now, so the next one is coming up. The government has already banned it because of the COVID-19 restrictions. So we're yet to see how they will use the national security law. And we'll have to probably wait until next year's one to see if they're going to allow this vigil to go ahead. Now, it is every year it is a big embarrassment for the Beijing government because it is the only vigil of its kind that happens on Chinese soil. So I think most people assume that the government will ban it, and we've seen the last, you know, authorized vigil, but that still hasn't happened yet.
James, it's one we'll watch over the next few weeks as we count down to June 4. Thanks for being with us. As always, that was Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau Chief James Chambers. You're with The Briefing here on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. A global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Vas Narasimhan, MD, has been CEO of Novartis since 2018. Since taking that role, Dr. Narasimhan has led a strategic and cultural transformation to build a leading medicines company, globally powered by advanced therapy platforms and data science. Under his leadership, the company has completed over $70 billion US dollars in strategic transactions. During and after his medical studies, Dr. Narasimhan worked extensively on a range of public health issues in low and middle income countries, and he continues to champion global health priorities. What does overcoming the immediacy bias in terms of how we work mean for Novartis' leadership? Vas Narasimhan, has the very nature of leadership itself shifted in uncertain times?
When I reflect on it, there's a huge immediacy bias, especially as a CEO. You have to kind of constantly remind yourselves because you're taken up by world events, you're taken up by the events around you, and you think the world will stay this way. But of course, the world is constantly moving, constantly changing. And given the complex world we live in, you have to keep reminding yourself, don't over extrapolate from the moment. And when I think back to last year, we did have a moment in time, you know, where we thought, okay, maybe do we even need offices? Now it turns out our realization is we need to give people a lot more flexibility. We have a global program called Choice with Responsibility that gives the associates the choice as to where and how they work if they're in an office-based role. But we also see that if people don't have the opportunity to meet with their colleagues, that their overall mental health and well-being goes down. People are fatigued with the endless, you know, Microsoft Teams and Zoom meetings. That innovation, culture, all of these things require face-to-face engagement. Even for a company like ours that has to engage with physicians, so much of the conversation is not just about the facts around our medicines, but also around empathy and the emotions associated with caring for patients. All of these things can't be transmitted through a screen. So I think it's been a rebalancing. On one end, we've swung the pendulum. Okay, maybe we could be completely remote. Now we see that office space is important. And we will give people the flexibility, but also with the knowledge now that people want to be together, that a big part of your life is spent with the company you work with. And in Novartis, we have this goal of reimagining medicine, and that a lot of that comes from talking with your colleagues. So we're proud we got 100,000 people on. You know, we're able to work seamlessly remotely, and we're able to, as I said, keep our business operating normally. But I think we're all looking forward to the time we can get back in the office and see our colleagues.
Vas Narasimhan, Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You're back with The Briefing and me, Tom Edwards. We're going to turn now to Colombia, a country that's witnessed widespread political unrest in recent weeks. Anastasia Maloney, Monocle's correspondent in the Colombian capital, Bogota, joins us now for the latest. Anastasia, thanks for being with us on the programme. And maybe you can set the scene a little. If we roll the clock back somewhat, nominally these protests began against tax reforms, but they've turned into something rather different from that.
Yes, Colombia is now in this eighth day of national protests, thousands and thousands of people have taken to the streets, particularly in the capital, Bogota, and in Colombia's third city of Cali. And originally, the protests were triggered by a very unpopular and controversial tax reform that the government tried to push through. Many people saw the tax reform as an extra tax on the poor and middle class. Part of the proposal of the tax reform was to put extra tax on basic foodstuffs. And that particular part really annoyed people and upset people, particularly during the pandemic when so many Colombians have seen their businesses closed. There's millions more unemployed, millions more poor. And so the tax reform was a trigger, really, to get people out on the streets again. In fact, the protests have started just before the pandemic kicked off and the outbreak of the pandemic. And the protests died down because of the lockdowns. And now the tax reform got people out on the streets again. They've changed a bit during the days that people have been out on the streets. Now people are talking about reform to health, reform to education. People are talking about better access to those key services. In fact, the government was forced to cancel the tax reform, but still people are out in the streets demanding that the government takes tackling poverty and inequality seriously, has an action plan in place, and also that more people are vaccinated. The vaccine rollout has been really slow in Colombia, and people are saying that government's not doing enough to ensure people get vaccinated.
I mean, is there a risk then, I say, is it that almost the demands of the protesters, they are, of course, disparate groups, and we know that the character, the nature of the protest is slightly different in these different regions, almost loses a coherent message and it becomes a broader demand for reform and to be listened to, and actually that the nuance of changes in education policy or in health provision are less important than a public appetite for meaningful change to come out from the centre?
Completely. The problem is that there's so many demands now on the table that it will be very hard for the government to give the different groups and the unions what they want. The way the government has decided to go about it is to set up a series of meetings with key groups and to hear their demands. And that already started yesterday. The president met the palace with key political leaders and unionists, and now he's got a whole agenda for this week to talk with teachers, the strike committee, lorry drivers, and all sorts of associations to try and come to some sort of consensus about where the country should be going and what are the key priorities. Most people agree on the key priorities, which is let's get people back into work. The vaccination program must be stepped up in order to have some sort of recovery, an economic recovery because of the pandemic. But obviously the way that the government's going to go about that is very different. And particularly since Colombia is a very polarized society between left-wing groups and right-wing groups, it's very difficult to reach some sort of consensus in the center. And that's going to be the big challenge at the moment. But first of all, the government needs to get control of some of the streets in some parts of the city and in Cali. The protests have turned very violent. About more than 20 people have been killed in the protests. And there is a sense that, you know, the priority must be to de-escalate the tension before anything can happen.
Well, I did want to ask you perhaps just finally, Anastasia, about that escalation. And specifically, you mentioned Cali a couple of times. We know that as a province, to generalise somewhat, you know, there's maybe a propensity, a tendency towards these kinds of expressions. There are broader concerns about still the ongoing role of ex-paramilitaries. There's a lot more arms on the street, for example. Is there a worry that there are these specific sort of, I don't know, powder kegs that the government needs to address perhaps with even greater urgency?
Yes, there's always been these hotspots and points of powder kegs, as you say, and that's also to do with, you know, the conflict and the peace process with the FARC and the much older peace process with the paramilitaries, which people many would agree that hasn't resulted in real peace or benefits for the people. In fact, the government was blaming armed groups and drug traffickers for inciting the violence in Cali in particular. There are lots of people that do not agree with that view because it is clear that there are not drug traffickers in the street. They may be behind it according to the government, but from what people can see is doctors, nurses, teachers, young students. These are the people on the streets demanding that the government hears their voice. And in a sense, they have been heard because the government was forced to cancel the tax reform. And also it led to the resignation of the finance minister. So the protesters have achieved quite a lot. But now the real work comes in actually deciding what are the priorities and how is the government going to deal with all their demands.
Anastasia, always good to speak with you. A very grave situation, but thanks for making sense of it for us. That was Anastasia Maloney, Monocle's correspondent in Bogota. You're with The Briefing. That's all we've got time for on today's programme, which was produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. My thanks to them all. Goodbye.